My name is Jay Holman. I am ASA, and you can see that I am honored to be a 45-year-plus member. You didn't know they let 10-year-olds join in those days, but what can I say? Brian, I didn't know you were emeritus, man. Are you old? All right, Brian.
Well, anytime you have advances in technology, it tends to bring new ethical questions to the forefront. And that is certainly true of the field of genome editing, which is really, in the last 10 to 12 years, has really advanced tremendously. And that coincides with the development of a technology called CRISPR-Cas9, which was developed in 2012. So in this talk, I'd like to consider the ethical questions, some major ethical questions that are raised in the use of this technology, specifically for editing the human genome. And when I talk about editing the genome, I'm talking about making targeted modifications to genes, specific genes in the genome. And we can talk about these kind of alterations by comparing somatic versus germline alterations, and also therapeutic versus enhancement type of modifications. And then you can combine those terms. So you can have therapeutic somatic genome editing in humans, the goal of which is to cure serious genetic disease. And it targets specific alterations to specific genes in the body cells of a given patient. It's restricted, those changes are restricted to the patient. They are not passed on to future generations. You can also think about therapeutic germline genome editing in humans with the goal of preventing the onset of serious genetic diseases in the resulting embryo. Alterations are made to early human embryos, or theoretically could also be made in adult gamete-forming cells, which are used for generating embryos. And the intention there is to transmit the genetic alterations to all the cells of the body, and these alterations would be passed on to future generations. You can also think about non-therapeutic somatic or germline genome editing in humans, the purpose of which is to introduce enhancements or new characteristics, not to cure genetic diseases. Possible examples could be to improve athletic performance, confer resistance to infectious disease, or even possibly enhance intelligence or lifespan, among others that have been proposed. This is the tool, CRISPR-Cas9, that changed everything in 2012. Before, other technologies existed, but this one enables you to fairly easily change the target of editing and the nature of the edit. And that's because the site of editing is determined by an associated guide RNA tells a protein called Cas9 where to make double-stranded cuts in the DNA. And these cuts then are repaired in two major ways, one by non-homologous end joining, the other one by homology-directed repair. The first one is more efficient, but it makes more mistakes, tends to cause short insertions or deletions. And that's fine if your goal is to knock out the function of a gene, but if you're wanting to have if you're wanting to correct the gene, that won't work. For that, you need homology-directed repair, but it's a very inefficient process, only works during a specific time point in the cell cycle, and really it's hard to efficiently accomplish what you're wanting to do. Now, these are certainly important issues. Other important issues include making alterations at sites that you don't intend to make. These are called off-target effects or off-target modifications. And that could be catastrophic for an individual that received those kinds of modifications. And so it raises serious safety concerns, which until recently have been really fairly dominant in terms of thinking about the ethics of genome editing in humans, whether it be somatic cell gene editing or heritable gene editing or germline, also known as germline gene editing. It turns out this technology has improved somewhat in the last several years, such that the efficiency of making desired alterations has improved, as has minimizing the on-target insertions or deletions that would result from non-homologous end joining, and minimizing off-target effects. And these innovations have largely come about from technologies that are a spin-off of using CRISPR-Cas9, but modifying that system in order to do base editing and prime editing, which instead of cutting two strands of the DNA, it cuts only a single strand. And that changes everything in terms of how the repair. It uses a different repair process. And so that improves the efficiency, the accuracy, and avoids off-target effects to a much greater extent. It also greatly expands the repertoire of the kinds of modifications that you can make in the human genome. So that some have estimated that over 90% of the genetic diseases, the monogenic human diseases, could be corrected using base editing or prime editing. Now, another way of improving the safety is using editing delivery systems that are efficient, specific, and minimize adverse reactions, especially by the immune system. And typically, they strive for virus-free delivery vehicles for getting the targeting, the editing machinery into the cells. So things like virus-like particles or lipid nanoparticles have been used for in vivo genome editing. Electroporation can be used for if you've isolated the cells in ex vivo editing too, and I'll talk more about both of those terms in just a bit, but you can use electroporation if you've isolated the cells and you alter them in vitro and then put them back into the patient. That's an efficient way. Injecting into the organ prevents, you don't necessarily want alterations made to all cells of the body. If you can localize it by injection into a specific organ, that helps. And also limiting the lifespan of the editing tools helps as well. By using the protein or the encoding RNA for Cas9 rather than putting the gene for Cas9 into the cells and having it be permanently expressed in the cells. Now, it's amazing. I attended a international summit virtually in March, and so much progress has been made in somatic cell gene editing. And I'm going to talk about one of those, sickle cell anemia, which is caused by a defect at a single location, single amino acid substitution within the beta globin protein encoded by the beta globin gene. And of course, that causes aggregation of the hemoglobin molecule, resulting in sickling, which causes obstructions in blood flow, causing severe joint pain, severe organ pain and damage, and potential for stroke. Conventional treatments typically are blood transfusions and drug therapies to kind of spread out the time frame between subsequent blood transfusions. The only cure, which can be done oftentimes, is to do a bone marrow transplant where you're transferring hematopoietic stem cells from a matched donor. Now, one company, Vertex, actually it's a collaboration between Vertex Pharmaceuticals and CRISPR Therapeutics, has had a lot of success recently with human genome editing, somatic cell human genome editing, using an ex vivo approach where they take out hematopoietic stem cells from a patient, they edit it in vitro. In this case, what they're doing, instead of correcting the beta globin gene, they're actually causing expression of fetal hemoglobin. And so it confers a therapeutic effect expressing fetal hemoglobin, which is normally expressed as a fetus, and then it switches over to adult hemoglobin. Here they're reactivating the fetal hemoglobin gene, and it's curing patients. Some 30 patients have been treated so far, and great success. The oldest the longest patient is Victoria Gray, who actually spoke at this international summit. She's been symptom-free for almost 4 years now, and her life has changed, utterly changed. Now, the bad news of this is that it's very expensive, and it requires long stay in the hospital. And, you know, we're talking about, when we're talking about expense, we're talking about $1 to $2 million a patient, which is just impossible. It's just, it makes it unattainable for most people, even in the United States. Who's going to be able to afford that? And it raises serious social justice issues too. If you think about, you know, not only those in this country afflicted with the disease and can't afford it, but think about sub-Saharan Africa. You know, they only have 3 transplant centers in all of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, where they even could think about doing this kind of technology, let alone having the expertise to do the molecular editing side of things. And so what we really need is, I mean, ex vivo is great. This is a proof of principle. But what we need is a simpler method that can be implemented around the world. And that's where the next approach, in vivo editing, comes in. Innovative Genomics Institute and a collaboration of 2 schools in California are, what they're trying to do is they're injecting the editing tools. They've been a little bit vague on all the details of how they're doing it, but it's in vivo editing. They're getting the tools to the bone marrow and to the hematopoietic stem cells, and it probably involves directing the tools through the use of antibodies that recognize cell surface markers. But the goal here is a one-and-done kind of editing where it alters the cells in the patient, no hospital, no lengthy hospital stay, no removal of cells from the body, and it has the potential to, you know, accomplish the same thing, only at a much more reasonable price, and using some of the technology, you know, in terms of how it's delivered, isn't so different from what's done for COVID, you know, the immunization for COVID. So that's kind of the trend in the field right now, and that's where it solves the equity issues, to a certain extent. But now we need to involve African scientists and scientists from India and other countries where there's a huge incidence of sickle cell anemia. All right, now let's transition to germline genome editing. And I think it's fair to say that the ethical questions that are raised by that are much more severe than it is for somatic cell. This has been done, as far as we know, only once, and it was done in China. And you probably heard about this in the news in November of 2018. Dr. He Jiankui announced that he created the first genetically edited babies, twin girls, and this received rapid and widespread condemnation from the scientific community. Basically, what he did was he knocked out a mutation, or he targeted a knockout mutation to the CCR5 gene in the girls using CRISPR-Cas9 system with the intent of conferring resistance to HIV, which uses that gene, that cell surface protein, to get into cells. And so after making the alterations, he allowed the embryos to grow and culture, then transferred them into a uterus of a woman, and then the babies were born in mid-November. What ethical issues are raised by that work? Well, the change, for one thing, it wasn't really therapeutic. It was an enhancement to confer resistance to HIV. And secondly, there were, you know, this, he didn't really make the alteration that he thought he was making. It was basically a type of alteration like the kind I showed you with non-homologous end joining, you know, where you blast, you know, a particular area, you could insert or delete, but not really controlling specifically what's happening. And not, you know, and using the technology that has frequent off-target effects. Of course, there are potential questions for future generations. You know, what if there are some unintended consequences? Will that negatively impact future generations? I mentioned the second item. The third, it turns out that not having a functional CCR5 gene also increased the risk for life-threatening complications from diseases caused by West Nile virus or influenza virus. So you're just trading one potential benefit for potentially, you know, some negative effects. It's not clear that the patients were suitably informed of the risks to the children. And there was absolutely no external ethical oversight. He didn't even inform his university in advance of what he was doing. And it seems like there was the potential for financial incentive, since he had two affiliated biotech companies that could stand to gain if this technology worked and was popular. What are the broader issues raised by germline genome editing? Well, what really is our obligation to future generations, since they don't have an opportunity to give informed consent? On the one hand, we could say, you know, we could ask the question, do we owe them protection from potential harm by avoiding germline modifications? Should we not do it because it might cause potential harm? On the other hand, if we have the ability to fix a gene for future generations and don't, could that be ethically problematic? So it's, you know, you can look at it from both sides. Is it ethical to genetically screen IVF embryos for certain traits to decide which embryos will live and which will not? Now, one option, you know, skip the editing, just screen embryos by pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, and don't use the ones that have the, you know, are carrying the mutation, and only use the ones, you know, don't use the ones that are carrying it. Only use the ones that aren't carrying it. You avoid any possibility of further damage to embryos, you know, unintended consequences. The question is it even ethical to think about doing this embryo selection at all, even without human genome editing? Are people with genetic disorders mistakes that need to be corrected? Now, certainly, you know, you want to alleviate human suffering, but what about the potential psychological impact on people with these disorders if you, you know, if there's, you know, widespread implementation of correction? You think about countries like Denmark, there's widespread genetic testing of the fetuses during pregnancies. And if they show signs of Down syndrome at like a 97% rate they get aborted. Could that kind of, you know, I mean, it's what it's done is it's created a stigma on people with Down syndrome in that country. Could the same thing happen if we start doing genome editing? Potential for promoting negative attitudes in society, promoting a quality control mindset toward human reproduction, that children are a product rather than a gift. This might actually be more come into play if we're talking about enhancements rather than correcting disorders, but it's still an issue. Correcting defects, could that be a slippery slope toward introducing enhancements? If we use the technology and it works, what's so bad about, you know, if you want a blue-eyed kid, making sure that happens? Or, you know, I mean, or you know, giving them advantages like better ability to manage oxygen in their bloodstream and or better muscle mass or something like that. It does seem like it would have an impact on athletics and other venues that where you typically celebrate human achievement. Is this human achievement or is this clever editing? You know, is it an appropriate use of resources? Do enhancements raise social justice concerns in terms of equity, giving some people unfair advantages? And does it really, you know, I actually heard someone sometime talk about the potential to direct the course of human evolution. You know, what hubris, really. Is experimentation on human embryos even ethical? This would be necessary, and it is being done to perfect the technique of human embryonic editing. They're just not putting them into, they're not using them for pregnancies, but they're definitely doing it. I mean, some might say that embryos have a status, a moral status, and shouldn't be experimented on. All right, let's consider in the few minutes we have left potential theological issues raised by genome editing. And we heard yesterday a great talk that talked about the, you know, the image of God and what that means. And you know, it does sort of imply that human beings have a certain dignity that we need to respect. And even, you know, you talk about the least of these, you know, the marginalized, those living in sub-Saharan Africa who don't have the resources, you know, what can we, you know, or in this country, there are plenty of people who are struggling in this country as well. How can we treat them with the dignity they deserve? Do reproductive and genetic technologies fall under the stewardship responsibility of humanity to God? I mean, after all, God gave us dominion over the rest of the living world, but is human genome editing somehow going too far? Is it playing God? Personally, I hate that phrase, playing God. I think that it really, at the root of that, is kind of an anti-science type of sentiment, and I don't think we should go there. And scientists who are engaged in this enterprise have very noble goals in curing human disease. Is it appropriate to interfere with natural reproduction if you embrace natural law theory? You know, you might have problems with this. And that could be a talk in itself. Human life itself is of higher value than the quality of human life, some would say. And that, I mean, we all, after all, have thorns in the flesh that we have to deal with. But how do you look someone with bone-crushing pain in the face and say that there's somehow a redemptive purpose in suffering, that if we have something we can do to alleviate that suffering, shouldn't we do that? And so, I mean, could that really be the important part of medical interventions? or to start considering enhancements really kind of muddies the issue of what is a medical intervention and what is not. Carl Henry said that there's clear biblical support for technologies that restore what God purposed in creation, but no clear support for manipulation towards perfection. Are we meant to have power over future generations, and how far should we take these technologies? And we need to avoid, in our faith-based response, an anti-science mentality. We need to have a national and international discussion about this technology, and the governance of it is very important. And as Christians, we have an important voice, important role to play, and we need to not be on the outside, but on the inside.
So your last slide there, number 8, please. There is clear biblical support for technologies that restore what God purposed in creation, but no clear support for manipulation toward perfection.
Right.
The part about restoring what God purposed in creation. That seems to assume a default idea of what it is to be human. I mean, in our DNA, there are evidences of retroviruses.
Sure.
is part of what makes us. Where do we draw the line?
Yeah. And you know, I think someone who believed that mutations were the result of the fall might more likely embrace that particular viewpoint. But if you believe that God created mutation for generating genetic diversity, and that one of the downsides of mutation is that it can have detrimental effects, then that doesn't work very well. Yeah, good point. Yeah.
You raised a lot of important questions and didn't provide a ton of answers, which is fine. But
there aren't a lot of easy answers.
So my question for you is going to be, are there any particular writers, thinkers, any books that are people who put forward helpful frameworks that you found useful?
Well, I just reviewed a book that by Massman and Fox called Modifying the Genome, I think has a lot of, you'll see that review probably in the December issue of PSCF. I was told that it might be there anyway. I think that it has a lot of good, that's one that comes to mind immediately, and it's one that I recently read. That are doing ethical analyses, or let me think about that some more. No other books are coming to mind right now. Yeah.
I'll blush and say that a book I find really convincing on all of these questions is called Changing Human Nature, published by Erdmans, that I wrote about 10 years ago. That one makes sense to me. How about just picking on one very practical, concrete question? You gave us an example of innovative genetics coming up with an in vivo, in-life treatment for sickle cell disease.
Right.
If, when they did that gene edit, they could not only heal the patient, but also their children, would you object to that, or would that sound like something interesting?
That question came up during the international summit. You know, is it possible to think that in the process of doing this in vitro genome editing, that it could affect the germline, the cells that give rise to gametes? I hate to formulate an ethic based on the outcome, and say that if it works well, yeah, I'm all for it. And if it doesn't work well, I'm against it. Because, you know, either one of those things could happen, right? You know, it may very well be that the technology will come to a point where the problems with even thinking about germline gene editing, at least on the basis of safety, go away. I think, you know, for therapeutic, I'm much more sympathetic to therapeutic. I mean, I have a grandson with a genetic disease, and my daughter is thinking about having another child and thinking about using in vitro fertilization and selecting embryos without it. You know, what if they could do genome editing, you know?
Yeah, to that point, my wife is Teresa's spinal muscular atrophy, which you may know is one of the first genes. In fact, Francis Collins showed one of the first cases who received the gene therapy. And it's $2.1 million. You want to buy it? Insurance companies often deny that. I don't know, but there's usually a battle, and Charlotte usually wins. One of the mothers who's quite promiscuous, quite not paying attention to everything, had a baby who they retreated, and then she got pregnant again, and second baby with SMA. Is that... What about adoption? You know, how do you change those values? Yeah. And she was the earliest baby ever treated. Anyway, thank you very much.